This is Their Life Story Podcast with Robin Levine.
I have always believed that everybody has something to teach all of us. In this series of interviews, I will talk to all types of people in order to learn from and be inspired by them and their life stories.
Guest this week is Jamie McCartney. Jamie and I grew up together, and he's been one of my best friends since as long as I can remember. Jamie is the physical performance lead and technical push coach for Bobsled Canada. Before that, he was the strength and conditioning coach for Alpine Canada, and he's also worked with the U.S. Paralympic ski team. Jamie has also been a bobsledder himself and a university football player. In this episode, Jamie talks about being bullied growing up, learning to stand up for himself and then his friends, a couple of extraordinary bar fights, trying out for a football team despite never having played, making it, going on to play university football, how he got into bobsledding, coaching the Canadian Alpine team, working with the Paralympic ski team in the States, traveling all around the world, his wife, and the work ethic and mentality it takes to be successful in life. What was it like growing up in Smithers for you? Like, what were some good memories? What do you associate with your youth?
Well, I lived in Houston until I was seven, right? Yeah, seven, and then I moved to Smithers between grade two and grade three. Which, I mean, it's like right down the road, but when you're a kid, you're like, it's a totally different town, whole new world and stuff. And, but pretty much in the region and stuff, I lived my entire life, most of my childhood anyways. And like, my experience is that, outside of the teenage angst and stuff that kids go through or whatever, but when I look back at my childhood here, especially after going out and stuff, you recognize like how fortunate you are to have had, you know, been in a town or a region and stuff where like outdoor activities are just at your doorstep all the time. You can ski and snowboard and go fishing and hiking and hunting and stuff and everything. And then also in large part, my time in Smithers and stuff, we spent a lot of time up in Ski Hill, which was awesome. We spent a lot of time out at Babine Lake and stuff, camping a lot. You know, I did a lot of fishing growing up, camped pretty much every weekend through the summer. So, like, there's not a lot to complain about on that front. I wasn't really that into school when I was young, like studious about school. So school to me was more of a social time, and that gave me the ability to play sports a lot, essentially. Like, my major driving force behind even, you know, putting any effort into school was to be eligible to play sports and also to not be in trouble so I could hang out with my buddies. As long as I did good enough just to sneak by on that, I was pretty good. So that being said, I didn't put a lot of time into school, so it gave me more time to go out and have fun. In large part, we fucked around, me and you together, for a long, long portion of those years, right? Like, up on the ski hill and doing all that stuff, right? So, the childhood here was good, which is in large part why we opted to move back here, because we have a son now, and I wanted my kid to be able to like walk to school, you know, and like go out and play and be a kid and do all that rowdy shit that we did, you know, over the years, and like not, have the same worries as being in the city that you'd have to have as a parent. So like, my overall experience was really positive, outside of, you know, probably some periods of time where, when we first moved and you didn't really know anybody and stuff like that, or, you know, typical stuff that kids deal with, you know, you deal with bullies or friendships or, you know, the teenage angst and girls and stuff, but that stuff kids go through everywhere. But like, the opportunities that Smithers afforded us as kids, I think, was pretty unique. And it still holds a lot of that uniqueness that a lot of places don't anymore, but still has managed to grow into a bit more of an affluent community. It's definitely like the nicest place up in the north.
Yeah, it's an awesome town. Was dealing with bullies and stuff, was that where you kind of started like not taking shit from anyone instead of your friends?
Yeah, in large part. So when we lived in Houston when I was a kid, I dealt with some bullying there. But I was younger and I wasn't really able to defend myself. And then, so I got beat up pretty good number of times and, you know, mentally got torched quite a bit. When I was a really young kid, I was allergic to everything. I was allergic to everything. So I was that kid at the party that couldn't have ice cream and I had to put like apple juice on my cereal. Right. So this is all this like cannon fodder for kids to make fun of a kid. Like I literally had it all. I had like asthma and allergies and like a dent in my chest. And like, I was a kid that kids picked on. So I, you know, in large part, so, and I didn't take it, you know, I took it to heart a lot and, you know, I was very hurt by it and stuff. And then, you know, we moved to a new town and then, it was, you know, I was from the neighboring redneck town when we moved to Smithers. Right. So then I wasn't exactly welcomed with open arms by a large part of like kids and stuff either. So, you know, my early childhood and stuff like that, you know, dealt with a bunch of that bullshit. And then, you know, I hit puberty quite young, and grew and then started standing up for myself. And then, kind of that ended up becoming in large part of person who I was, where I was going to stand up to any bully at any time, and protect someone, even if I don't know them, if I felt they were in trouble or being bullied. And that became part of, I guess, who I was, because I just had decided to stick up for myself. And when I saw people that couldn't or whatever, maybe that, it, you know, it stuck with me and I realized I had the ability to do it and I wasn't going to take shit from anybody or see my friends take shit from anybody or even, you know, a complete stranger that was not able to protect themselves.
It's a really cool quality that I've always admired in you. And I kind of took advantage of being such good friends with you.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird, you know, you look back, we're adults now and stuff and almost everybody I know or talk to or something has like significant memories of that, of me. And I guess I didn't really think about that at the time. You don't really realize that you made that impact on something, but I've had a lot of people say to me, hey, like, thanks for always having my back. Or do you remember when you protected me here or whatever? And it wasn't a discriminatory thing. It just became ingrained in who I was and what my response was to stuff like that. Like, I don't really have a flight response, you know? Yeah, that's what it is. And like, you know, it's just who I am. I'm not afraid of it. I'm not out looking for it. It was in protest to bullies. It was in protest to people that think they could walk around in life and take advantage of people either physically or mentally or whatever. I was like, okay, well, try and do it to me. Let's go. Right. Like, you want to bully someone, bully me. I can take it. I took my lumps for a long time and then I was able to stop people from taking them. And then I was able to stop people from giving them to other people unnecessarily. And then I probably gave some to some bullies that needed them to change their path because you can't walk through life and bully people. It should be about love and respect. But if you cross that line, you know, we can sort it out.
Has that changed since you've like gotten older and you're kind of like, probably like, okay, I've been in enough fights. Like I need to learn how to like talk things through or like, you know, just call people out on things instead.
Yeah. I mean, I've matured significantly on that front. Obviously become better at extinguishing conflict verbally. You know, but I think the intention of my capacity is still the same. You know, I will still be the one to try to defuse the situation. I just have better tactics in doing it now. And if it ends up going that far, that ends up becoming the resort, but I'm better at taking care of it on the front end. But I still am, you know, in large part, you know, willing to face that conflict head on, which I think is a big reason why maybe I've had some level of success as a coach, because I'll stand my ground and I'll stand up for the people that my athletes and they know that, and I'll always be straight up with people and straightforward. And I think it's that same quality. Like, I'm not gonna run from conflict. It's not always physical conflict, but mental conflict or emotional conflict or anything like that. I'll you know, I'll take it head on. And I think being direct in that front, being the way that I operate and stuff has served me very well. And I kind of firmly believe we live in a world where we could probably use a little bit more transparency and a little bit more direct communication and stuff with certain things. And maybe a little bit more of a direct approach too with overall, you know, conflict resolution. And, you know, I don't really live in a world of being able to be passive aggressive, you know, see, like it's, you know, we need to do this right now to succeed or we're not going to succeed. There's no, you know, there's no middle ground for sometimes having an argument over stuff. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, grown up, matured, got, you know, got a family, stuff like that now, but I'm still willing and able to protect my family if I have to. That's something that I'll always commit to being able to do.
Are there any stories from like your earlier days or the days that you were a bouncer that kind of stand up for conflicts or even non-physical ones where you had to like stand up for somebody or you had a conflict with somebody at work or that you worked with, like an athlete?
Oh, I mean, there's lots, you know. I mean, you know, well, you've met my friend Dave Brown, like one of my best friends. You know, we met essentially in the midst of a massive barroom brawl. At a club that we both worked at. We didn't know each other from a hole in the wall. I got hired at this club. I needed to make some extra money. I was going to university, you know, didn't really have two pennies to rub together and I needed to eat a lot of food. So I had to make some cash and, you know, I got a job at this club and I think it was like my first night working, go to bounce, whatever, this fight breaks out in the pool room right next to where I'm posted. I run in there to break it up and then shortly after have the entire pool room turn on me and whoever else was entering, like with swinging pool cues at us. So I end up seeing this huge human being come flying in the other side and we basically looked at each other and went back to back to protect each other and said, like, I got your back if you got mine. And we ended up fighting our way out of there to a great deal of success that probably didn't feel too great for him, some of the people on the receiving end, but you know, when you're getting hit with pool cues, you got to do what you got to do. And then shortly after that, we ended up moving in with each other for a while. And then Dave got me into playing football, which was a whole other world, you know, in large part. So like that one's kind of memorable because it was actually like an insanely wild, abrupt level of conflict that I was just involved in that I, you know, wasn't mine, right? It wasn't, you know, I was just going to like do my job. Hey guys, you can't fight in here. Got to get out of the club. And the next thing you know, I just getting wailed on by pool cues.
It's funny because I kind of don't picture you even like normally having to take pain. Did you even notice the pain in that situation?
No, I didn't there. Not until later. And I mean, I wasn't too worse for wear. I've definitely had other situations where I've felt the, you know, worse after and stuff, but typically in the time I've actually never really felt a whole lot in terms of pain and usually just had to suffer with it after.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a few pretty memorable ones. I've had, I got jumped by a bunch of bouncers in Germany once.
Bouncers?
Yeah, it was, I'm not really at liberty to go into too much detail I worked with a coach. We were at a party after a world championships, just having fun. And I come around the corner and this coach I worked with had an enormous guy sitting on his chest, just punching him, like just pumping the guy's eyes shut. And the coach isn't a very big guy and he's definitely not a fighter. So I just go and pull the dude off of him. Well, it turns out this guy is a bouncer and his entire crew saw me haul him off. So then they all jumped on me. And so I had to fight, like, I don't know, double digits amount of bouncers to get my way out of the bar. And then I got outside and realized that I had a chain that had a ring on it from my uncle who had passed away. And the chain had got ripped off and the ring went missing. So then I tried to fight my way back into the bar to get it. until the point where like they were just so, I did this enough damage that they like barricaded the door to keep me outside, and then the bouncers wouldn't come out, and I was calling them outside, and I said, if you get like, let's keep rolling this. And I was so mad because there was no ill intent there at all. And then next thing you know, I'm involved in this like, who knows how large Donnybrook in the middle of Germany. it was a bit of an experience, and for whatever reason, for probably maybe some of my own doing and whatever, but I've been in a number of those scenarios, and I'm still alive to talk about them. And
so did you never get that chain back with that ring on it?
No, ring's gone.
Oh, that's too bad. That sounds like a really important ring.
Yeah, like I was legitimately devastated, very upset about it for a long time. I didn't enter that evening. There was no ill intent going on anywhere at all. Like it went from 0 to 100. There was no conflict, and the next thing you know, like I'm in the middle of it. Right, very strange scenario. So, and after it all, I was just so mad. We got a cab ride back to the hotel, and I was just so devastated. I even talked to the manager before I left, because I had met him inside earlier. He saw everything happen. He was apologizing and kind of told me to get out of there. And so I did. But I got in touch with him, and I even tried to get a hold of him the next day to say, hey, like, did the cleaning crew find it on the ground or anything? But like, I never got an answer. And I'm pretty sure even if someone did find it, it wasn't making it back to me.
Yeah, they probably didn't like you. You mentioned Dave's getting you into football in Lethbridge. Can you tell me a little bit about just how that came out of nowhere? Because you hadn't ever played football before, had you?
No, I mean, they didn't have it up here. So I played pretty much all the other sports that they could I could get my hands on up here. But I always, when I was in high school, I had an infatuation with football. I always wanted to play. Felt like it was a sport I was kind of meant to play. And I remember even being in high school, having a point in time where I was considering, like, should I maybe try to go billet down south somewhere and see if I can get into a high school football program and finish out my high school and go play some football. But I ultimately decided, like, I wasn't ready. I didn't want to leave the sports teams I had up here. I didn't want to leave my friends up here early, so I didn't. So I'm down in Lethbridge, going to the University of Lethbridge, doing some martial arts and working. And I met Dave, and shortly into us meeting, and I think right around when we moved in together, we were actually went out for wings and a beer on like a wing night, just hanging out, playing some pool, and started. He was playing up for the Calgary Colts in Calgary, and it was in his off season when we met. And so he was in between seasons, and he was back in Lethbridge, and he was talking about football, and I was asking him about it. And somehow in the conversation, he said, well, like, if you want to try it, I'll try and see if the coaches will let you try out. So he went and talked to them, and I don't think they were too keen on it at first because I'd never played, but he convinced them, I think maybe even by threatening to go play for a different team, and got them to let me try out. I'll have to verify that with him, but I think he used some forceful tactics, and so they kind of just rolled their eyes and said, okay, we'll let this guy try out. So we started once a week, we started driving up from Lethbridge to Calgary, and I'd go to these team runarounds. So I kind of started learning a little bit what was going on. I was just sitting in the back of the like lineup of drills and stuff. And then we got to a spring camp, and I figured I would put on the gear. I'd do the spring camp. I'd get my ass handed to me through the week. And then they'd be like, okay, like, thanks for trying out. See you later. And then I did the spring camp, and then they invited me back for main camp. So then I was like, well, I don't know if I'm going to make this team. So I couldn't commit all the way to moving up to Calgary. So I basically went up through main camp, kind of went up homeless to Calgary and just on a leap of faith and said, well, if I don't make it, then I'll just go back to Calgary. I'm going to school anyways. But if I do make it, then I'll find a place to live and I'll do whatever. So kind of, I think we went up and we stayed at like people we knew's house or something in the basement and just lived kind of homeless, went through training camp. And then I was, kept to them, the team. I made the team after main camp, and I was kind of like, oh, so I guess I play football now. So I made the team. I ended up doing a visiting student transfer That semester I took off school and then just played football that semester, and got an apartment right across from our practice field and just started, you know, kind of becoming a football player. And so, I think maybe second or third game into the season or whatever, all of a sudden I started getting some snaps and then I started playing really well. And then I came back for my second year with Calgary. And then by then I was like a full-time defensive fixture, ended up becoming the captain of the defense. And then I kind of realized, I'm like, okay, like this is actually starting to become part of my life. I was training for it in the off season. I was, you know, excelling at the position and starting to actually not just become like an athlete that was on the field, but a good football player. So then I decided, you know, I'm already going to university. I'm going to try to play for a university team. I did a couple years in Calgary, went and did a couple years in Victoria, and then I signed with Simon Fraser University to play a couple years there and finish off my school, my degrees that I was already working on already. So I ended up going to a few different universities on the path too. I like did some, you know, transferred, lost some credits, had to make them up. So it kind of spread my university, the time it took me to get my education finished done, but it was, you know, well worth it. Cause I went from never playing to all of a sudden, you know, I was going up and playing university, and then I had some opportunities in the pros, and, you know, and I was facing some shoulder injuries there, and, you know, eventually ended up blowing my shoulder up and had to make a decision whether I was going to step away. But yeah, pretty much in a blink of an eye, I went from never playing the sport to next thing you know, it was like, it was my full-time job. I was playing for a CJFL team and living up in Calgary. We're like packed into an apartment and just going to practice every single day and training every single day. And then for the next however many years of my life there, football was like full-time all the time, that in school. And I had every ambition to go have a pro career. Some injuries kind of thought otherwise. So then that I had to make some other life decisions.
Were you getting paid to play football for a while?
I was getting scholarship money, and then had I been able to fulfill my contract and not blown my shoulder up, I would have went on to a pro contract. But got released on an injury and then could have went back, but I would have had to taken a full year off. And then by that time I had gone through the recruitment process to go to Bobsled Canada to push bobsled. Actually, at that point, I had every intention of going back. I was going to go back, whether I got released out of Hamilton and was going to go to a different CFL team, or I was going to check out arena football, or all my options were open. But I was like, in the meantime, you know, while I let my shoulder, well, both shoulders essentially heal, to get to somewhere where I was like, okay, I can go like play full on football and not be worried about my shoulder coming out of its socket every time I go and make contact or even roll over in my sleep. I had this opportunity to try to maybe, you know, go push bobsled with Canada. So I jumped on that train, which was a really cool experience, because then I was in a situation where I was going into another sport again as an adult that I've never done or been around before, and had to like go through the process in quite a quick learning curve. You know, which is funny to look back at now, because however many years, 11 years later, I'm now working for Bobsled Canada. But
yeah, which must have been a connection between having been a crew member and being a coach now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm the technical push coach now for the Canadian bobsled team and the physical performance lead. So the physical performance lead side came from my strength conditioning coaching development, essentially. And then because I'd done the sport too, they developed kind of a new position for me where I oversee the physical development of the athletes, but then also the whole technical push program for the program. So pretty much all of our actual technical development of how and why and what we do pushing a bobsled, that's my domain, as well as overseeing all the athletic development, you know, physical development of the athletes.
So how did you get that break to come and just be a bobsledder for Bobsled Canada in the first place?
First of all, they recruit, and we do the same thing, they recruit kind of a specific type of athlete, kind of a strength, power, speed athlete. So a large part of the recruiting contingent are athletes, men and women that come out of track and field or football or rugby, that usually typically test, physically test very well. They run fast, they're strong, stuff like that. So, you know, at that point, my testing numbers were publicly listed under, you know, in, I think you could see them on SFU's website. They were in the CFL like combine database. And a lot of those tests, they do similarly for bobsled. You run a sprint test, you do, you know, your power cleans, your squats, your bench press. They want to know how physically strong and fast you are. And bobsled does the same thing. So they can look at those numbers and say, okay, this guy is 6 feet, 230. He runs this fast. He lifts this much weight and stuff. Okay. We typically know that athletes that can do that, we can at least coach them to be bobsledders, you know, to simplify things. That's really what you're looking at. You want to, who's a physical freak? Who's an absolute just specimen, can run fast or hard. And at that time I was training at a, I'd say a really high level. I was very, you know, fast for my size. I was running fast. I was jumping high. I was extremely strong and powerful. You know, by the measuring stick of football. So they thought, okay, this guy's got some tools. Now, once you get to bobsled and you really refine that linear speed and that power and stuff, you get even faster and more strong. But, you know, I met these physical requirements to, you know, make the team. So then I went through that whole process. So it was like they were in the process of recruiting because it was going into the Vancouver Games year. So there's a lot of recruitment going on. And I happened to step away from football because of injuries for a bit anyway. So the timeline just kind of linked up, right? Like I was already, I don't remember how long, X amount of months into my rehab and already getting back to training to come back for like the next season of football to try to see if I could, you know, crack into a pro roster, you know, without an injury.
Yeah.
And, so this was, it was actually an opportunity for me to like train for something and possibly go compete. And I was like, well, what do I have to lose? Right. Like what's, I don't know. They want to come and physically, they're going to come to Vancouver and test me. And if I do well, then I'll go there. And then they're like, yeah, you come to Calgary and we'll go from there. So it's like, there was literally nothing to lose and everything to gain. So I was like, you know, and I was kind of stunted because I was a little bit uncertain what I was going to do because I, you know, I really was wanted to be an athlete. I wanted to play football. I wanted to compete. That was still in my heart. Deep down in my heart, I wanted to go compete and, you know, pour myself into it and use some of the things that I've been training so hard to physically obtain, to be able to run that fast and jump that high. And then it was automatically just kind of right there, you know. And I was like, well, I grew up in doing winter sports, hanging out in the snow in the winter, ripping down all over ski hills and GTing down the mountain at night and stuff like that. I'm like, you know, sure, put me in the back of a bobsled. Like I'll survive. Like what do I got to lose? So let's roll. And then that spawned that whole thing.
What's it like the first time you get in a bobsled and go down those crazy tracks?
It is unique, man. Everybody, I think anybody that's ever done it, like really, like not like a tour bob, like actually gone and gotten in the back of a, like a real race bobsled. We'll probably tell you that it's a very unique experience. I'm sure everybody has different. My very first trip ever, we crashed. Ever. First run was in Whistler. Whistler's the fastest track in the world. This is before the games. So the track is like, was premium hard. Like there was like, they had a corner called 50-50, like literally 50% of the sleds were just crashing in there. They ended up changing it a bit going into the games and then even subsequently changed it. But when Whistler first came about, it was the rowdiest thing the bobsled world had ever seen. And my very first time ever in the sport, we're just in Whistler. I go off the top and corner 12. Well, I think he messed up on 11 and then 12. And then we rolled into 13. And we were probably upside down for at least a solid second, maybe two, before I realized we'd crashed. Because when you're going down the track, you don't know where you are, right? And the G-forces make it feel like you're upside down and, right? So it's a very unique sensation. So next thing you know, I like felt weightless for a second and then this big slam. And I just thought that was part of the sport. And then I realized that my helmet was smashing against the short wall and my shoulder was starting to like burn from the ice. And then I just like pulled myself from the sled and held myself in there. And it sounded like shearing metal was going past me, you know, and we're going 145 kilometers an hour or something at that point, or, you know, you cooking along, like, you know, really fast.
maybe. And at that point, you're not in anything. It's just you on ice.
You're in an ice coffin. You're in this little, like, carbon fiber covered coffin. And I'm not driving, right? So you're just in the back. So your job as a crew is to push it and then just jump in. And you're now along for the ride, right? So you're like, you develop this inherent trust with the person that's driving you. Well, like, me and this guy are just getting to know each other. We just met too, right? So, like, he doesn't want to also injure anybody in the back. So I'm sure there's a lot of stress under him. Like, he felt terrible. I remember the look in his eyes when we dumped. He's like, oh, are you okay? Are you okay? And then I got this massive adrenaline dump and I was like, yeah, I'm fine. Let's go again. And which I don't know if that's everybody's response, but like, I was so hyped on adrenaline that I wanted to go again. And then they looked and like, well, you need a new helmet. Cause my helmet was just like smashed down the middle. I took a pretty good dinger on it. So that was a very unique experience. And then, you know, but you got to get back on the horse, right? Like, I didn't want it to psych me out. And then we went, and then I had a whole bunch of successful trips down the bottom. And then you kind of start to learn where you are and like how to breathe. Cause when you're at the bottom of Whistler, like when you hit corner 16, there's like 6+ G-forces and you're like in a 2-man sled, you're like bent over, like kissing the floor between your kneecaps. And so if you don't breathe at the right time, the amount of pressure that comes in your face, people have just started having like bleeding noses and stuff. And then you have all those G-forces. There's like blood flying up into people's face or snot or whatever. So like, you need to learn how to relax and breathe through it and know when the pressures are coming. The first time you're in a sled, you don't know any of that. You're like holding your breath and gritting your teeth. And it's like the longest minute of your life. And the whole time you're just going down, you're like, holy fuck, holy fuck, holy fuck. Cause you realize like, I'm not steering this thing. I have no control over what's going on. And it's just picking up steam down this ice chute.
Did you know what you were getting yourself into when you did it?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't totally disillusioned to what I was doing, but I think reality is never always – you can have all the expectations in the world, and then the reality hits, and you're like, oh, man, this is actually pretty rowdy. Like, this is – you know, this isn't for everybody. Right, you learn a lot about who you are riding in the back of a bobsled, especially your first time down. You know, like, and it's not for everybody. I've seen it many times. There's a lot of stories about it. You know, people come, they do it, and they're like, "Nope, I'm out. That's not for me." You know, and that's kind of what makes it uniquely special too, because you got to be like a special kind of crazy to go, you know, out there and sit and send it and do this. And now I'm fortunate. I get to help develop this program and develop these athletes and try to help them, you know, hit these physical measures and also develop the like vibrato, like that type, that little bit of swagger in their step. Like, yeah, I'm going to step up there and go crush this thing. Cause if you go step up there and you have any amount of fear in you, you're not winning the race, right? It's just not going to happen. You have to be going up there ready to kill it.
Did you learn to love it as you kept with it?
I think I loved it right away. I loved, it was just such a unique experience, and like, it was kind of scary, but being scared, I like fear. I mean, I just feel like I grow from fear. I got to face it, right? Face your fear, grow from your fear. I became addicted to facing my fear or doing something that I shouldn't be able to do or doing something that people didn't think I'd be able to do or something that scared me. Right. Like, when you face that fear, I felt like it made me, stronger. I actually felt like it made me more emotionally intelligent and to understand who I was and recognize that I can't, you know, I can overcome some stuff, so I don't have to be crippled by fear. To say that you know I was never scared would be false. I get scared, but like, what I recognized and I loved about it right away is A, that I felt like I could actually be pretty good at it, and B, there's a technical component to it that I found to be, you know, like all the like ins and outs, you know, of the drivers and the equipment and all this stuff. It's like, you know, like racing, right? Very fine tuned, very focused. I was very intrigued by that, you know, and then like just the raw sheer animosity and power and like the adrenaline that comes with that. I really fell in love with that. And then I fell in love with facing the fear that is unknowing, you know, you're going to go out there and push this thing and get in, and you know, not only do you not want to crash, but you want your pilot to nail a run so you're flying, right? So you're just hauling. And to see if I could push myself beyond a limit of fear where it was just no longer existent. My only concern was pushing the sled as humanly fast as I possibly could. And that's a learned response. So I like putting myself in situations where it's not comfortable to see if I can, make it comfortable.
With those uncomfortable situations, that probably comes into play a lot with all the coaching you do with your athletes now, hey? Like whether it was bobsledding or the U.S. Paralympic team or Alpine Canada, it's probably a lot mental because they're all obviously very capable physically, but a lot of it is like getting over mental hurdles all the time, I bet.
For sure. I mean, so from a coach's perspective, everybody has, their own developed philosophical driving forces or an overarching philosophy in which they, and you know, sometimes there's sub philosophies in there and stuff, but some very, people are very rooted and by the numbers and stuff. And, some people are operate very highly on the artistic end of the scale and their creativity level is very, very high. I think in large part, I was able to blend both because I worked across, I was an athlete in a bunch of different sports and I went through some of these emotional challenges, especially like when I walked into football, man, like I'm the guy in the locker room that everybody knows has never played this game. When you're trying to make the team, these guys are competing against you. So first they think you're a joke, right? And then they see you as a threat, but they're a threat that they don't know how to deal with because you're just blindly dumb out there being like, I don't know. Yeah. So like, you realize that not everybody was your friend in that situation. And I had to make up for that with like effort, right? I had to make up with that with intent and heart and, someone's not going to outwork me or whatever it was. Because I had to do that, I think I know how to convey that to athletes. So if you get a very, very gifted athlete that can then attribute that level of work ethic, to their arsenal, right? And that level of care and to detail and stuff, then they're very dangerous. I had to do that to survive. I had to be in the film room more. I had to be in the weight room more. I had to do the extra drills after because I was making up for 19 years. Well, let's say some kids started playing at 5. I was 19 years old when I started playing, right? So I didn't have any of that. So you got to make up for it. And then in helping athletes achieve their goals, right, I think I could got something that I can draw on that is palpable for them because it comes from a meaningful place. I didn't read it in a book. It's like, well, how did you achieve this? I literally worked at it as hard as I possibly could. I took a risk at it. I went into going and playing football totally poor, didn't even have a place to stay. I was just going to flop on couches until I knew I made the team. And then I was going to do that. And then same thing happened when I went to go to SFU. I couldn't even afford a hotel. So I slept in my car to go to training camp and stuff like that. I made sacrifices to get there. Got the team there and, living in Vancouver is not cheap. So until I had roommates, I was flopping on people's couches. I had to work night jobs and stuff to pay my way through. You got schoolwork and stuff, even just getting through that takes sacrifices, let alone trying to succeed at it. So when I go to work with other athletes, regardless of what the sport is, the intent has to be the same. If you want a desired outcome, and even for the most part now, even if someone's really highly talented, if they don't even possess some level of this drive and stuff, it's very, they're just going to get outworked. And so any athletes that I work with, they'll know deep down in a short period of time that there's not really a length I'm not willing to go to help them succeed, or I'm not going to ask them to do something that I wouldn't do myself because I will do it myself and I'll do it with them right now.
You know how you're so willing to do the work it takes to succeed in any given situation? What's your driving force to succeed?
I think when I was young, I didn't think much of myself. I didn't think I was very intelligent. I didn't think I was really good at much. I was pretty early on, you could tell I was pretty good at sports and stuff like that. But I was at that point, I was rarely the best on a team all the time. I was pretty good. I liked to play sports and stuff. I definitely didn't feel good academically and stuff like that. So I think I had some, I started to become kind of complacent about it. I was I'm just kind of dumb or whatever. But then I when I started doing stuff that I liked, that I really liked, I started to feel better about myself. And then I started to kind of tap into my emotional intelligence a little differently and then saw things through a different lens. And then I think things started to snowball that I built confidence off of it, to the point where then my fuel to succeed was to realize, and I don't know when it happened, that the only limiting factor to my success is really me. And by thinking that I was dumb, I was therefore going to be dumb. Or thinking if I couldn't achieve something great, I was therefore not going to do it because I wasn't going to try. And in large part, the reason why I felt that way is because I wasn't looking back. Like, I didn't do well in school when I was a kid because I didn't really try. Right. And I didn't try it and I didn't do well. And then the teacher said, you don't do well. And then you believe it and then you just don't do it. So I kind of had to break that cycle. Once I got beyond that, and actually became like, I'd say considered, you know, once I got into high school and stuff and more proactive and like, okay, I'm going to go to university. I'm going to do these kind of things. Then it kind of shifted to, you know, it wasn't like I was a kid and I was like, I'm going to go do this. I actually don't think I had a lot of aspirations as a kid. It came later. It was more, at some point in time, I recognized, and I don't know if it was like because I went to a funeral or what, but some point I had this realization that as far as anybody can prove to me, like with some level of facts where there's no doubt, this is the only life that I know I have to live. It's the only one I know, right? Maybe there's an afterlife, maybe there's not, but you know, let's just say I'm not willing to take that bet. This is the one that counts to me right now. What am I going to do with it? And I realized that also after it, that success was to me, wasn't the accolades and stuff. It was, can I achieve some goals I set out to achieve? And in doing so, can I befriend great people around me? Can I be there for my family? Can I be the best dad that I can possibly be? I started to challenge myself to do these things in hopes that the day that I die and do pass on my gravestone, you know, or the people that surround me and stuff like that, they remember that legacy of who you are and what you meant to them, not necessarily what I did. But I have to have channeled that outlet somewhere and challenge myself. And I was given opportunities to challenge myself. They just happened to be athletically and then subsequently academically and stuff because I was in university. And I realized that if I didn't give everything I had to try and to achieve them, then I would be selling myself short because I was given golden opportunities. It took sacrifice, but I was like, well, someone says, like, hey, I'll give you a chance to try out for football and you always want to play football. I'd hate to wake up 20 years down the road and be like, man, I wish I would have done that. Right. And not just then once you do it and you're like, well, if I'm going to be poor and do all this and stuff, it's got to be for something. Right. You got to at least like do what do I want to look back and just say, hey, that was fun. Remember when you like kind of tried? You know, like, so the driving forces, I think, changed. But I think in large part of my adult life, it really boiled down to I'd like to have, you know, leave my family and my friends and stuff with some level of legacy of trying to do or achieve great things, whether I do or not.
Speaking of your family and friends, you're one of the most loyal friends. Like if I think, who do I know that would take a bullet for me without a doubt, I would pick you 100 times out of 100. So why is loyalty like so important to you? Like what, where did that come from? And why is that your main currency in life?
I don't, you know, it's once again, like, I don't know why or how that developed over, like there's not one specific moment where I can say this is where it came from. But in large part, you know, maybe why, for the same reason, you know, why I wanted to succeed is that the moment I passed, the loyalty that you had to the people around you and the things that you did, that's all that exists. The money disappears, the things disappear, but the story of who you were can live on. And if that story doesn't include in the header loyal, then, you know, I didn't really do a good job being the best friend and partner and family member that I could be. So to me, loyalty is king. Actually, loyalty is like the number one currency on the planet. And, you know, loyalty is earned and lost and stuff amongst discourse and stuff. But in my world, what matters to me, the currency that I hope to be the most rich in is attributed in loyalty to the people around me. And, you know, to the things I do, to the commitment I make to my job and the commitment I make to the athletes that I say, I'm going to help you do this and stuff. You know, I have to stay loyal to that. Or, you know, what is the opposite of loyalty, right? It's disloyal, dishonest. So in order to hold myself accountable, if I want people to remain loyal to me and life to remain loyal to me, then I have to be loyal in return.
Wow, Jamie, that's like words of wisdom. And I think it's a virtue. I think that's got to be a virtue.
I don't know. That's just how I conceptualize it, because it is something I've actually, you know, put thought into and stuff before, because I did recognize like that's a major thing in my life. And I didn't, you know, like I said, can't really name why. But, you know, like I said, if I were to pass tomorrow, and if people were to speak at my funeral and could say, you know, he was a very loyal human being, you know, very loyal, was always loyal to everybody in this room, then to me, I did some things right.
Yeah, it's important to you, people say when you're gone, not just like what you get out of life while you're here and how much money you earn.
No, I mean, obviously, I want to provide for my family as much as I can, and I want to achieve success, right? Like I want to take these athletes to the Olympics and I want to win all the medals, and you know, that's who I am. But I would never exchange loyalty for that success.
Speaking of your athletes, like, so what are some places with all these different organizations and all the different types of athletes that you worked with? Like, what are some of the like most special things? Was it kind of like seeing what the Paralympic athletes were capable of, or seeing just like what someone is capable of, or like places you experienced, or like what are the bonds you made?
Man, that's a doozy. I mean, there's a lot of things. So here's a very unique thing. I think this was a maturing point for me as a human and as a coach was, I mean, obviously the time I spent working with Alpine Canada and the Canadian Sport Institute and stuff, and I developed some incredible bonds with these athletes to the point where I actually said no to the Paralympic job first. I turned it down. And then they were persistent, and I did it because of, I was loyal to the athletes. I was having this internal beef with myself. I was like, you know, we were about halfway through the quad to go to Sochi.
Right.
No, sorry, to Pyeongchang. We already went to Sochi, so it was between Sochi and Pyeongchang. So it was about, you know, I left in 2016. And I developed some very close bonds with some of these athletes, in large part, like some of them, you know, came into the program as like young or like older teenagers, like 18 years old, and had spent 6 years straight, at like 11 months of the year with me. They spent more time with me than anybody. And I watched them turn in from like, you know, teenagers to young men and development team skiers to World Cup fixtures and you know, winning World Cup medals, World Championship medals and stuff. And so that's extremely rewarding. But I got to a point where all of a sudden I realized I'm like, I have a growth opportunity here. And actually even talking to some of the athletes, and they're very, very supportive of my decision to go. And I left and still stay in touch with them, but I went to the US Paralympic team, which was like a very conflicted scenario for me, but I saw it as a very good opportunity and a very good challenge because I saw it as that, but I was actually even, I underestimated like how much of an opportunity and challenge it was going to be. And what ended up happening is I stepped in the scenario and you end up with a cohort of athletes that have everything from visual impairments to missing limbs to spinal cord injuries to and some of them were due to injury and some of them were born like that. So you have this variety of what we'll call quote unquote disabilities, amongst this group. And we are to travel around the world and compete at these international events, just like we would with a normal team. Well, yeah. If you think about, so here's an example. When we're in soft space, Switzerland or Zermatt, and you're on a glacier training, typically you're on, the coaches are on the lift at 5 a.m. and the athletes are on maybe at 5:30. So say you're my athlete and you're going to get on the lift at 5:30 in the morning. Well, imagine being in a wheelchair now and having to be ready, get ready and be on the lift at 5:30 in the morning. Yeah. And how much more labor intensive that is. And we're in like this little European hotel that sometimes doesn't even have wheelchair ramps. And they've had to travel over with 20 pairs of skis and all this stuff, pushing themselves through an airport in a wheelchair or on a single prosthetic or traveling around blind with a seeing eye dog and all these things that you take for granted. And now I'm traveling around the world with these athletes. And every single one of them did not want to be treated different. Not a single one. If we said you had to be on the lift at 5:30 in the morning, they were busting their ass to be on the lift at 5:30 in the morning. That meant they had to be up at 3:30 in the morning to be able to get themselves out the door, do the catheter and stuff like that. And I purposely pushed them and I treated them as if no different. I was like, you guys are a national ski team. We're going to operate like a national ski team. We're going to train like a national ski team. And obviously we're going to individualize things to your needs and we're going to work together at this and stuff, but I'm not going to treat you any different. And it was one of the most rewarding experiences because I recognized that even if I felt like I was having a hard day, I can't even fathom how much more difficult it is to navigate not just the regular world, but to go be a high performance athlete in a world, traveling around the world internationally, executing a sport, also with, you know, all of these other obstacles that you have to deal with. And health concerns and all this stuff. And it was a very humbling experience. And I think it made me a better person from that. And it made me a better coach, particularly from a compassion side. But also I realized in going back and working with, say, able-bodied athletes, you know, there's really no excuse for them not to be on time for the vehicle to leave, right? There's really no excuse for them to miss that workout. There's no excuse for them to not do these things because I've seen people with far greater challenges in front of them on an everyday basis that had to struggle through those and still managed to get their ass out of bed and out to training and, you know, do what was asked of them as coaches and deal with the weather and deal with the hotels and do all this stuff. There's no excuse. And there was no excuse for me to complain about it or to worry about a hard day. Right. And when, you know, I worked with an athlete that literally had both his legs blown off in Afghanistan and part of his hand.
Wow.
You know what I mean? And he told me the story. And he, you know, and none of them complained. When I train these athletes, we go to like Chula Vista, California. I put them through the ringer legitimately sometimes. Like it was not a cakewalk. We trained in a very intense environment sometimes. And I mean, obviously making changes for people and the way they embraced it and embraced the challenge and embraced me as his coach in doing it was like mind blowing. And I walked away from that situation, totally a changed man for the better because I just could not see the world through a different lens again. That was the lens that I saw it through, like, you know, and realizing how, you know, fortunate you are to have all your limbs and your vision and your health and do all these things and not have to face these challenges. And not only that, but then to see them go and excel. And I think we went and won like 9 or 12, I can't remember, like medals at the Paralympics and got to see them fulfill that kind of stuff. And, you know, some of them were like going to school while they're doing it too. Like it was, you're talking about highly ambitious people that, you know, one guy is running a large medical sales business back while he's like in Europe, ski racing. And, you know, he became paralyzed in a car accident years ago, like just absolutely humbling. So, you know, that to me is a monumental time point in my kind of development as a human and as a coach. And I can largely attribute any success I have after this down the road or buy-in that I have from athletes or anything like that was built off obviously the backbone of working with Alpine Canada, but then making that move and putting myself into a very challenging situation. Like they'd never had a full-time strength conditioning coach. They'd never had like a sport performance program. They never really had the true physical testing. Like I had them in the physiology lab and we were taking, you know, anthropometric measures and looking at force plate data and taking their blood lactates and, you know, manipulating different tests that, so I could evaluate whether at that athlete, you can't really compare the athlete to athlete because they all have different disabilities, but you could track, is that athlete getting better in certain things as an anchor point of, are they adapting to the programming? And it was a really neat experience because they basically just gave me the keys to the kingdom and said, we don't do any of this stuff. So like, can you create these testing protocols? And basically it was my own experiment based off my experience. And in doing it, I didn't even realize what I was walking into, but there was like a massive psychological development for me because all of a sudden I was faced with, how do I push these athletes to be great, but still stay within their bounds of capability without alienating them in some form or fashion? You know what I mean? Like when you have to be aware of these things and account. So when I'm programming for them, you have to be able to account for like what limb is like every athlete has a different unique need. So all of a sudden then you have to become very creative in everything that you're doing. Wow. So my creativity as a coach became higher. The way that I cue people to do stuff, because like say I'm cueing a guy to do something and I go to show him a visual, but the guy's blind. Well, I had to learn how to like, you know, talk to him about stuff and actually like verbally cue him, and then would actually physically like help move his body so he could feel it, you know? So I had to learn different strategies to get an outcome in very creative ways, because every athlete was unique, right? Like even the spinal cord athletes, like depending on how high the spinal cord injury was, determined how much core stability they had, which then would limit certain exercises that we would need to do. So you'd have to become creative with that, you know, visual impairment. You'd have to be creative with that. Whether someone, you know, I worked with an athlete, she had a single arm, single leg on the same side. So she was unilateral on the same side. Right. So how do you develop specific exercises for her to achieve what she wants? Wow. There's no book on that. There's barely any information on that. So then it's taking concepts that I know to be true and use with able-bodied athletes and then creatively manipulating them to try to get a similar outcome with this athlete, given the information, the variables that I know to be true. And then it's kind of like a feel-out process, and it's a bit of an experiment, and is this working, and can the athlete do this? And so it's a very exploratory process, and to go down that road with individual athletes who had, you know, have gone through their entire life with some of these things, or their newer injuries or whatever it is, you know, is a very unique experience. And I learned a tremendous amount from them, and I'll always hold like a massive place in my heart and my memory working with that group, because it was just such a immense growing time for, I guess, pretty much every aspect of who I am as a human.
Did it teach you a lot about what you're mentally able to overcome? Like if they can mentally overcome that and still be elite athletes, then what you can do with the power of the mind?
That's why I was kind of like, that's where I realized, I'm like, there's really no, I saw things when working with this cohort of athletes that all of a sudden made me realize like there's not an excuse out there for other people for these things. You know, there's just not an excuse. I couldn't like, there's no like, you know, there's certain things you can control. You can't control the genetics that you were born with. There's certain things you can't control, but you can control your effort. You can control your intent. You can control whether you're on time for stuff. You can control how engaged you are in things. You can control these things. And I'm like, if these athletes that face immense amount of challenges that we can't even comprehend on a daily basis can still adhere to these concepts with the utmost degree and respect, then there's no reason why I can't hold myself to that standard, and I can't hold any other athlete to that standard, or anybody that I work with in any business that I do. You know, it wasn't about being outcome focused. It was about being process focused. And then the outcomes just, you hear about that all the time and everybody's like, oh, that's really cliche, but it very much is. Because like working with this cohort, a lot of times we didn't, you had to be creative and you didn't know exactly what the outcome was because they'd never done this before. There wasn't a book on it. So we just became process focused and bought into the process and started talking on a common ground and laid out expectations. this is what it is, guys. If it's training time, it's training time. If you're not here 5 minutes early, you're late, right? You warm up. This is why you do things. This is how you do things. This is what you're going to do. They were doing, they were working with mental performance professionals, nutritionists, doing all their exercise physiology lab testing, training daily on snow, daily in the gym, everything you could ask athletes to do, but doing it and having to face other obstacles that we can't even comprehend. If all of a sudden, imagine right now you went to go carry, I took them surfing in San Diego. We went like rock wall climbing. We went zip lining. We would go do these adventure training camps down in California. I'd have, you know, doing stuff like that. And I'm like, I couldn't fathom going and doing that. Like right now, I wrap my head around going and doing that in a wheelchair or trying to go execute that blind.
Yeah.
Right. So that's a lot to overcome. So in working with them on a day in, day out basis, you start to, your concept of like what is hard, right? And like what hard work is and stuff changes a little bit.
Do you ever wish that you could work with a Canadian alpine Paralympic team? A Canadian winter sports Paralympic team?
I mean, I know the crews that work with them very well. I'm close to their coaches and stuff like that. I'm sure at any point in time, I could maybe go spend some time with them. I actually know a bunch of the athletes too. I became quite close with that whole international community because it's an international ski circuit, right? So they're from all over. You know, people also forget, like, these athletes are going ski racing. So you got athletes in sit skis or skiing on a single ski or skiing blind, right? And they go and charge down, like, at the Olympics, they race down the exact same hill that the Olympians race down in the Paralympics.
So if you're blind, like, how do you even do that when you're blind?
They have a guide in front of them. So there's three classifications of the blindness. Like, B1, like, you're totally blind. B2, you have some visual impairment. B3, even less. But you're all considered, like, legally blind. None of them can have, like, driver's licenses and stuff. But they get classified on that. But so B2 and B3, they have guides in front of them that they can see and follow. B1, because they can't see anything, their guide has a big megaphone on the back. And they follow them auditorily.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
So no matter the rating of blind, no matter the disability, like if there's a guy that's got missing both his legs and there's a blind, completely blind guy, are they all racing on the same course, like against each other?
They race on the same course, but they race within their classification. So it's right. All the sit skiers go against each other. Then they have like, well, sitting men and women, or, well, let's just say it's a women's race or whatever. You'd have sitting women. Well, usually, sorry, the visually impaired women will go first, and then the standing women, and you have all these different classifications of standing, you know, below the knee amputee, above the knee, double, whatever, arm, and based on the classification determines like where they fall, but they'll all compete against each other in standing women, and then you'll have all the sitting women, so on all the sit skis. So they all go, they'll go visually impaired, standing, sitting, and then based on their rank, their bib in there. So you'll have the whole women's contingent go, but then there's basically three different races going on within that.
I see.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was fair to have every different type of disability just competing against each other.
No, there's not. And it's, you know, it's an interesting learning curve too, because they, based on the classifications, they do this kind of, they have this actuarial scientist, the statistician that comes together and evaluates all their times and the time differentials based on classifications, and he comes up with factors, time factors. So say a B1 who's totally blind, he gets a certain percentage of time, so his time actually runs slower.
Oh.
Right? Based on his factor.
Right.
So it's kind of handicapped in that way. Right. Like they to level the playing field. So they're competing against each other under this factored time that's quantified over this massive data set by these statisticians to determine what that time factor differential needs to be.
That's awesome to know. I didn't know how it worked. In preparation for this interview, I started to slowly research Paralympics and how it worked, but that was kind of what I was still unclear on. I didn't get it.
Yeah, I mean, in different sports, you know, in swimming and stuff, they have different they use classifications too, but it might be a bit different. But in alpine specifically, that's how they'll do it under this time factor. So like, you're racing against your cohorts, but you're also racing kind of against your factor. If you're factored a certain time, you basically want to be skiing faster than what your factored handicap is. So then you're putting up a fast time. Is it a perfect science? I think inherently there's some, you know, over a large data set, looking at averages and stuff, I'm sure the factors are fine, but then you get into unique circumstances where not every hill is the same, the sets aren't the same. And the only unique thing about it that kind of rubbed me the wrong way is, like, say at the Paralympic Games, you're using all this factor data to figure out a time on a hill that has had very little races on it leading into the games because it's a new venue.
Right.
So like that venue, that type of slope could end up setting up way better for a certain type of athlete than another one. And they're already getting a factored handicap. So like they, for lack of a better term, they call it getting factor fucked. and that's pretty much the only contentious hot topic issue there, where, like, you know, they're using this kind of scientific or this mathematical validation to create these factors. But if all of a sudden we go to a venue and say, okay, this is the Paralympics, like you have one shot to go win this downhill gold, and you end up on a course that's very, very poorly set up for your factor, right? Then that could be it. You could be the best in the world, but it just, you know what I mean? So there's a little bit of discrepancy in there where I think it's not necessarily a perfect system, but at the same time, I don't know if there's a way that they could make it any better. I honestly can't really think of one because of all these variables. There's just so ski racing itself is a multitude of variables. The snow is never the same. The turns are never the same. The weather is never the same. You know, and then when you go to Paralympic skiing, all you're adding in is more variables, is that now all the athletes all actually have these different physical things that aren't the same. But like, so, you know, they try to control for what they can control.
It's so crazy that you have all these people that have all these reasons that they'd want to go slow down a mountain, and then they're trying to go as fast as they can down a mountain.
Oh yeah, man. It's wild. Tremendous amount of respect. If you ever get a chance to watch this, like a sit ski downhill or something, man, like, you know, like these guys charge down the hill, and some of the wipeouts are wild.
It must just give you goosebumps just being around that. There's kind of that like motivation and that like strive to succeed and overcome, and that willingness to overcome situations. It must just be moving.
Well, yeah. So it's a unique thing, right? Because I went from working with an able-bodied national team that gets a lot more exposure on a worldwide stage to working with a Paralympic team. But like, and most people don't even watch the Paralympics. And if they do, it's only during the Paralympics. They don't watch these other tours. So it's not like they're watching. There's a full World Cup tour that happens for 4 years leading up to the Olympics. A lot of people you talk to, they think the Paralympics and the Special Olympics are the same thing.
Right? No, they're not.
No, they're not. But a lot of people do think that. But when you actually go and enter into this world, you realize that these guys are some of the biggest warriors that walk, roll, hop, whatever, cane their way on the planet. Like some serious badass mofos. Some of them are ex-military, been blown up in combat. Some people have been dealing with this stuff their whole life. Like I worked with a guy, Tyler Walker, one of the biggest beauties ever. He's been his whole life. He has no lower limbs. He's basically got a plasia at his pelvis. He climbs entire mountains on his hands.
Oh my God.
He does full mountain climbs on his hands. He's a sit ski racer. He won they called it a monocross. They used to do sit ski cross in the X Games. Check it out. He won the first gold medal ever in monocross. And they're going off these huge ski cross booters and these spring loaded mono skis and just sending it off these things. And it's just mass carnage, right?
Oh my God.
And you watch this and you're like, these guys don't get, and girls don't get nearly as much exposure as they should, or applause as they should, because they truly are like absolute warriors. Because they're, you know, they're going out and they train hard. Like you look at those, any of the Paralympic events, you know, whether it's the swimming or, you know, the wheelchair racing or the para-alpine skiing, or they have para biathlon where they can't skate, so they're just like two pulling, like Nordic and stuff like that with the sit skis. Like these people have to give her, and they're just absolute warriors, like some of the toughest people I've ever seen. And I'm like, you know, I just feel like society could use that dose of humility. You know, I think I felt like that dose of humility was good for me.
Yeah, it seemed like it was really eye-opening to like what you're mentally able to overcome and to what the physical limitations of the human body are.
Yeah, for sure. And just, yeah, like it opened up a few different, I guess, underpinnings of my philosophy around coaching and subsequently life. I kind of coach like I do life. I just kind of go hard in the paint all the time. But you know, it's not without any intellect or thought or emotion, but what I've realized is this really opened up to me is that like we can really push the envelope and there's not really an excuse for me. Like I'm having a bad day. Poor me, like tough go. You know, like I still got to go out and I have to go execute exactly what I need to do when I need to do it because I got to lead these athletes to success. And like, the list of excuses, the true excuses for not doing what you need to do shrunk a lot for me. I mean, obviously there's circumstances where like, yes, athletes need to go take care of their family or need to go do that kind of stuff. Right. But like, just those little excuses or like, oh, you know, I'm having a bad day or whatever. Like, I don't feel like doing that last run or just things like that. You know, or like, why weren't you on the lift on time? Oh, it's, you know, 5:30 is early. Okay. Tell that, you know, tell that to these athletes that are at the lift in a wheelchair.
Yeah. On time.
On time. Right. Like it's just, it just, you know, it gave me a different outlook on it. And then it also made me very fortunate to have lived the life that I lived, to feel that way, and to also recognize that like life is pretty precious. You know, when I start talking to these guys, he's like, yeah, like next, one second I'm standing on the roof, next thing you know I'm blown like 30 feet in the air. And I was like, okay, you know, and like medevaced on a helicopter and like legs missing and stuff like that, and you're like, okay, my problems seem a lot smaller.
Yeah, like compared to that, we've got it. We're rich.
Exactly, right? So everything is just due with some context. And it just changed the story of the context for me. Not to say I was totally disillusioned to it, but when you're around it at that scale, doing what we're doing, you really recognize that these people are warriors and we can hold ourselves. Everybody can hold themselves to a higher account.
Earlier at the very start, you mentioned if you don't act on things right away, you won't be successful. It's like, we need to work this out right away. We need to get this over with. We need to have, and it's done.
Conflict resolution or just with everything?
Yeah. Like when you, like, if you want success at things, you just like action right away.
Well, I mean, there has to be some level of, you know, if your first action is sitting down and then putting in a thoughtful intent of what you're going to do, then yes, that's action. But like, there's no point in humming and hawing about stuff. The world keeps turning, right? So it's like, if there's a conflict in a team I work with, we have to sort it out, or else it just sits there and stews into this vitriol of some sort of cancer that is going to overtake the team culture. It could go from an individual beef between two athletes and it can turn into something more systematic, right? So it's like, what am I to gain by not trying to resolve this right away? Like, there's nothing, you know what I mean? From that point of, and then with everything in life, it's like, you know, with everything, if there's an opportunity handed in front of you, at least sit down and take an action and make a conscious decision of what and why you're going to do something or not. But I feel like where it's easy to get lost is inaction. Is to put it off or to ignore it or to, you know, hide from it. Because logically, that if you really break it down, that doesn't get you anywhere, right? In life, we're faced with these, you know, multitude of variety of variables that are coming at you all the time. And you make decisions and interact with those decisions, and you essentially have to live with those decisions and stuff like that. But every once in a while, something comes in front of you and it's like, is this an opportunity? Yes. Evaluate. Okay. This is an opportunity. Is this an opportunity that I want or need right now? Yes or no. Right. Okay. Yes. Well, what does this opportunity entail? What is it? Right. Like just these active thoughts versus just letting opportunities pass you by. Well, the same thing with conflict. It's like, sitting there and just not acknowledging the big pink elephant in the room. And everybody says that all the time. It doesn't mean you have to go in guns blazing and be like, I'm going to squash this or else. It just means acknowledging that it's there. And I think in large part, maybe that's why I got into some conflict, is because someone would be throwing some shade at me. And then I'd be like, is there a problem? Like, do we need to sort it out? Right. And like, sometimes people just want to bump their gums to seem big, but it's like, if you really got a problem, we can sort it out. If not, then what, like, what's the problem? We don't have to hate each other. We can just be buddies. Right. We don't have, there doesn't have to be any bad blood, but like, if you're looking for trouble, then don't, we don't have to have a conversation about it. Right. Like, and just like, if you're, you know, if you're looking for opportunities, don't beat around the bush with opportunities. Sometimes you got to make your own opportunities. But I think actively engaging to dissociate yourself from conflict completely and not dealing with it. I mean, unless it's not yours and you don't have to deal with it. I'm not saying inject yourself in every conflict, but stuff that's at your doorstep, I don't see any positive purpose in not engaging with it right away and trying to engage it with it positively, obviously. But it's the same thing with, you know, grasping the bull by the horns with an opportunity. It's like, if you don't grab it sometimes, it might be too late, right? Or at least take the steps to acknowledging whether it is truly an opportunity or is it just a pipe dream? And then you have to determine really what is a pipe dream, because, like, you know, how achievable is something? And, you know, then you got to balance that with other stuff. But I think it's world that living in your life is a decision of, you know, taking things head on. Because if you don't, you put your head in the sand. You know, whether we like it or not, the world keeps spinning. Every year we get an extra wrinkle, get another gray hair. You know, life passes you by, and then you look back and say, I don't know, I don't want to be the guy that looks in the mirror and said, woulda, coulda, shoulda.
Yeah, that's all the motivation I think that I need for doing that. Yeah, thanks, Jamie. That was a great answer. That was partly kind of just for my own sake, too, just to hear that. One big thing I was wondering, I know it was really hard on you with like relationships and stuff in the past, because you did have like all these sweet jobs and these sweet opportunities and you were traveling like to Europe and all over North America like quite frequently. What was it like just trying to have a regular life? Was it kind of heartbreaking in like relationships? And do you feel like it was kind of bittersweet, like having like all these opportunities, but then just having it like a tough time with just keeping it like a girlfriend or just,
I mean,
your family, keeping in touch with your family?
Yeah. I mean, looking back now, you know, I have the most amazing wife now and stuff like that. And I think, looking back now, I think it was a good thing. It allowed me to go achieve some of the things that I want to achieve with and mature to a point and stuff where I was in a position to be the father and the husband that I am now. So it was almost like a blessing in disguise, because I was inherently gone all the time and stuff like that. It maybe kept me out of some relationships or scenarios and stuff that maybe would have detracted me from something or from the future that I have now. But it was definitely hard. Like, I was away from my family a lot. You know, from the time I was graduated high school, I was gone all the time, and you're grinding out, and it was a bit of a lonely existence at times, but a very worthwhile existence. And, you know, tried some relationships along the way, but they didn't work in large part because of that reason, or we weren't compatible or whatever. And at the time, you know, you're like, this is hard, this is heartbreaking, like my lifestyle doesn't allow me to do this kind of thing and stuff. But at the same time, you recognize that, like, when someone amazing did come, you know, and Kat walked into my life and she's been full nothing but supportive behind this and stuff, you really truly realize that I, you know, this is my counterpart. This is someone that understands who I am and what it is I'm trying to do, and supports it as I support her in return. So I think in large part too, is like, it definitely thins the herd of compatibility, but it doesn't mean that you're not, you know, I wasn't going to find it or whatever. At the same time though, like, you know, it like I said, it was a blessing in disguise, because it just wasn't my time to be settled down. I was meant to be doing that stuff, like, you know, working and building my career and trying to, you know, like the job that I do, man, there's no union. There's no, if you don't do a good job, you don't have a job. That's just, that's it. So I had to go earn my keep and say yes to every opportunity that came in my way and work really hard and scrimp and save so I could buy a condo and do all that stuff so I could maybe like retire one day and, you know, develop a life and everything like that. So looking back, I'm like, you know, these kind of temporary flutters that go by where you're like, oh, fuck, like another one bites the dust, I guess, you know, this just isn't the lifestyle for them. And you're kind of being like, is this the lifestyle for me? But looking back, absolutely it was. Yeah, that lifestyle at that time afforded me to get like to this point and get set up and stuff. And then also took me to the time point where I met my wife. And like, I can't even fathom not having her in my life.
What was it about Kat that kind of let you know that she was the last woman you ever needed, you know? Or like there wasn't ever anybody else?
Well, I mean, first of all, right away, very early on in meeting her, it was very, very, very apparent that her number one level of currency was also loyalty. And that for me right there is the first nail in the coffin. And then beyond that, like, I mean, obviously she's highly intelligent. She's extremely beautiful. She's very driven. You know, she's extremely compassionate. She's funny. She's a great time. She's got about the same amount of wild in her that I do, right? But also the same amount of hard work. And it was like the first time, it sounds weird, but like it felt like she was a female version of me. And because of that, she knew who I was. She understood how my brain worked and you know, why I'm so hyper all the time and, you know, why I'm studying stuff all the time and why I still go to the gym all the time and do all these things. And she was like, yeah, I do those things too. Like I'm fully supportive of it. Like to camp and fish and hunt and like all these things. I'm like, literally, if you were going to go into a computer and create the perfect woman for me, it was her. And then she just kind of popped into my life. And it was like, once again, like recognize an opportunity and seize it. Right. I kind of like the math was going in my head and I'm like, you know, cannot compute, like this seems too good to be true. And then, but you know, and then I talked to her more. I'm like, oh shit, like this girl is the one. So I'd say probably within a couple of weeks, I knew I was pretty much doomed in the best way possible. And then for sure, you know, I knew well in advance that I was going to marry that girl and then, you know, surprised her by asking her to marry me in Mexico. And then went back for a wedding the next year and stuff. And it was like, from the moment she was in my life, I just couldn't even remember what life was like without her in it. And
that's an awesome way to put it.
Yeah. And that to me knew it right away. But I remember the very first like kicker to me that right away made me realize that this might be a little different is like, I kind of I was at a point in time, like I said, I'm very straight up. I just asked her straight up, what's number one most important thing to you? And she said loyalty. And my jaw almost hit the floor. Not that that's like a totally unique thing, but that also typically, if I were to ask most females on the spot like that, I don't know if that would be their first response. Not to say that they're not loyal, but to hold it in such a high accord that's the first answer that comes to mind is a little bit more rare than I think people would think. Without, you know, if they heard this conversation, they'd be saying, but if you just ask someone as a social experiment in a relationship, what is the one thing that you value most? I'd be very shocked if almost anybody said loyalty is number one. That's it. If that's not how you operate, then I don't want that in my, I don't want like, not just that you're a loyal person, but like, if you don't hold loyalty up here, you're not really the right person for me. And she gave me like, that was her answer. And I was kind of like, you fucking with me? One of my friends pay you.
That was the perfect answer. But anyways, Jamie, thank you so much for like, sharing and it just being so genuine. I really loved it.
Hopefully in the next, well, if we ever get to having a Winter Olympics, hopefully I'll be able to tell you a story about going and winning an Olympic gold medal.
Yeah, totally, James. Totally. Yeah, I'd love to have another one too. I felt like I really like scooped out the jar of what I was looking for pretty clean there.
Right on, man. All right, brother. Well, I love you.
All right, love you too, man.
I'll talk to you later.
All right, thanks a lot, James. Thanks, brother.
All right.
Bye. I hope you enjoyed that episode with Jamie McCartney. You can find him on Instagram at Titan Performance. My next guest will be Elena Jean, Elena is a documentary filmmaker and photographer. She's currently making a film called Coextinction about the dwindling southern resident killer whale population in the Pacific Northwest. Thanks so much for listening to Their Life Story. If you liked it, please be sure to rate, review, share, or subscribe.